Yeah, what does that say up there? It says judges. That's judges in Albanian. And I thought I would just throw that up, you know, because Lois and I spent 2 weeks in Albania. And Albanian has three sounds in it that are not in English. And all three of them are right after each other in the beginning of that word. Gjysh taret. Taret. Those are actually three letters. The GJ is one letter. The Y, or E, is the second letter, and the Q is Q. Okay. And at the bottom, that's the 11th week. Yavin is the week, week of 11. Yom Bidiat is 11. Okay, so that's all we get. We're going into the last five chapters of Judges, and this is some interesting stuff. I have struggled over this, and I wish I could say I understood it all and could really present it, but we're going to have to work on this together. Before we go into it, Brother Harold is going to lead us in our opening prayer. Thank you. These next 2 weeks, this week and next week, we're going to be doing these last five chapters of Judges. Trying, anyway. We may not finish everything in 2 weeks, and we'll spill over a little into our last week. But where do these fit in the timeline? If we go back there to our timeline, it doesn't really say. We've gone through all these judges up through Samson, and now it's not really clear. You know, the presentation of Judges is not strictly chronological, so exactly where these things are happening is not that clear. For example, we have in these two chapters we're doing today, the migration of Dan, where some of the Danites go from the area that they were allotted up to an area way up in the north. Did that happen after the time of Samson? Perhaps. But there are just no clues. Well, if there are clues in there, I missed them. But it doesn't say specifically that this is when it happened. There are some wordings that make it sound like it was earlier, but in trying to dig into this, I was looking at Strong's numbers and, you know, looking at the translations they gave for the Hebrew words and what Hebrew words are used for it. And some of those words have a list of translations that are translated about 40 different ways, depending on context. So you'll see different wordings and different translations. There's some ambiguity here. I said this once earlier, I wouldn't put an awful lot on a specific word in a specific translation. Some of these, it's a good thing to read a number of them and try to get a better sense of how it all fits together. We have two major accounts in these five chapters. There's the one we're dealing with today, and then it really gets wild. I mean, this is a case where everything seems to be going bad. And I had this thought this morning. Our approach to this is something like forensic, you know, doing forensic studies. we see so much going bad. What can we learn from it? Well, look at what's going on. Try to understand what the people are doing and why they're doing it and how they got off on that track. Because we know what God said to do and we see what they're doing. What's the difference? And then, again, bringing it home, what are we doing today? Are we tending to make the same mistakes that they were making? We're human. We're the same animal today that they were then. So we have all the same tendencies, and we're subject to the same kinds of mistakes and foibles. Some words that come to mind in approaching is bizarre. I mean, some of the things that happen there are just, you say, what? Back screen's not on. Shocking. One challenge in studying these chapters is to kind of tamp down that reaction of, oh, this is horrible. And how could they do this? And the indignation and the disgust and the things that you might feel. Because if you let that block you, you're going to have a hard time looking at what's really happening. So try to, you know, yes, it happened. What was going on? How did they get to this place? And rudderless. We see this thing repeated several times, how there was no king in Israel and everybody did basically what they felt like doing. So they didn't have, they were not following this common theme and direction. They were just wherever. And especially in the stuff we'll be looking at next week, it gets really bizarre. So taking an approach here like forensics, you know, I would say forensic engineering because I'm an engineer, but this is kind of CSI OT, Old Testament. We have no heroes here. There are no judges. Nobody's stepping in to straighten them out. No heroes of any kind. There's very little mention of God, let alone having anyone who's obedient and faithful. This thing, there was no king in Israel. Every commentary you look at says, well, this is repeated four times, and this is keying on the thing that they needed a king. They needed a king. What did God say earlier? Were they supposed to have a king? Yes, God was king. And that no man needed to be king. He'll be your God. You'll be my people. But I was talking with Jason before this and said he really bailed out at the right time. But you could say, well, God knew what was going to happen, and so he's setting it up. I don't know. That's second guessing. We do not know. I don't know his mind to that degree. We have strange gods being worshipped, even made. In the book of Judges, yes, Samson was the last one. We know that Samuel judged Israel. He had the function of a judge, but he's not in here. He appears later. And I think some include Eli as a judge for that period, who was also the high priest. The Levitical priesthood seems to be, I don't know, in tatters or something. It's hardly mentioned. It doesn't seem to be functioning very well. So they had the Levites spread out all through the tribes, but maybe somebody can help us understand what they were doing. It's not really clear to me what they were actually doing at this time. They should have been teaching the people the law and all that, but who knows? When we read these chapters, we need to look at what the text says, but I would suggest we should also look at what it doesn't say. What is not said may be as important as what is actually said. Because it's not, this is presented in a reporting style, basically. This is what happened. And there's no commentary, except that thing about there was no king in Israel. But there is no commentary saying, well, this is where they messed up, and this is what they should have done. It's left to us at this point to look at this and understand it. At times, you're probably going to shake your head in disbelief and say, how could they possibly have gotten this far off track? Well, look around. We've got our problems today, and they're not an awful lot different in some respects. Let's get into it. Chapter 17, okay, standard American way of pronouncing it, Micah. Micah. But we'll go with Micah. He was from the hill country of Ephraim. That's all we really know. He had a place there, and the chapter begins, he had taken 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother. His mother had uttered some curse, cursing the thief, we presume, and he heard this and apparently was shaken by it, to the point where he says, Mom, that silver that you're missing, I took it. And her response was, oh, blessed of the Lord be blessed of the Lord, my son. You know, she's so glad at getting it back. And then what does she do? She says, she dedicates this wholly to the Lord to make a graven image and a molten image. So she's so grateful to God at getting her money back that she says, let's use it to break the second commandment. Wasn't that obvious? And wholly dedicated, consecrated to God. But then when she actually gave the money to the silversmith to make that image or images, she gave 200 pieces. Some think that she may have, I really can't part with that much, so I'll hang on to this and just give this part that looks good. Others have suggested that maybe that was the payment to the silversmith and the other 900 were used to make these images. We don't really know. At any rate, what they did do was make idols. How big is a piece of silver? If you assume it's a shekel, which was about a third of an ounce, that in today's money with the currently depressed silver prices would run around $6,000. So this is not pocket change. Apparently his mother had some wealth, and he had some wealth. Micah was not a teenager pilfering change from his mother's purse. He had sons old enough to consecrate one as a priest. So, what would you say? How old was he? 40? 50? Maybe 60? He was definitely a mature man, and he had a business going. The thing about the graven image and the molten image Some, you look at different translations, you get some treat that as one object. Young's literal translation uses a singular pronoun referring to them. Others use the plural. So it's not really clear. Somebody, one person said, well, you had the graven image, and then the molten image was the thing that sat on. I don't know how they came up with that. But at any rate, we have idols, these images used in worship, which were in violation of the second commandment. Micah had a shrine. This is from Hebrew, two words. One is house and the other gods. So you have a house of gods. Now we have shrines around today. What are they used for? What is their actual function? Ostensibly, remembrance. But when you go in the door or you're leaving, what's right there? Yes, collections. Now, it doesn't say this, but there are hints in here, at least as I went over and over this. My suspicion, I can't really, again, it's not stated specifically, but I suspect that he was running a revenue-generating thing here where he had this shrine and people would come and they would do their worship and leave money. And we'll, one of the things that kind of reinforces that comes in just a bit. Yes? There's that, and it's not just in the Middle East that they're doing that. There are a bunch of shrines around this country, and people make pilgrimages to them for, it makes them feel holy. He made an ephod. Now, if you're familiar with Leviticus, Exodus, where they were making all the priestly garments. The ephod for Aaron was something that is not really fully described, but it was something that was worn on the front, and then the breastplate with the 12 stones attached to it. But in this context, some commentaries say, they think there are at least two meanings or senses of this word, one being the garment and the other being some sort of image, something that was used in worship. Where David was on the run and he went and asked, I forget who was the priest there, but he asked, do you have a sword? And he said, the only one we have is the sword from Goliath and it's wrapped up behind the ephod. That doesn't sound like you would have a sword behind a garment that was this big. So maybe there is another meaning for this. But at any rate, it was something to do with worship, and it was something that your average person had no real business making. And as was said, he consecrated one of his sons as a priest. So now he's got these idols, and he's got the ephod, and there's all this stuff to make it a nice holy place, and here's his son. By what authority did he consecrate him as a priest? And a priest to whom? And then we get the first of these statements. In those days, there is no king in Israel. Let's leave that one for 2 weeks from now, when we can look back on this stuff. The Levite. This is the main character in this section. He was from Bethlehem, of the family of Judah, and a Levite. Now, I find that confusing. There's of the family of Judah, Levites were of the family of Levi. I don't get that one. Does anybody?
Yes. Well, the Levites didn't have an inheritance in the land, right?
Right. That's true. They lived amongst the others, but Bethlehem was not one of their cities that were given to the Levites. Now, if somebody suggested that he had been assigned to Bethlehem, I don't know how they operated. Did they send people out as teachers or something to the various other cities? These are just big questions. He left Bethlehem looking for whatever he might find. He wasn't happy there, or he wasn't making a good living there, so he just went out looking for something else. And he came to Micah's house, and Micah talked to him and said, "Who are you? Where are you from?" "I'm a Levite. I left Bethlehem. I'm just looking for something." Micah says, "Stay here. Work for me. Be a father and a priest to me." Now, that "be a father to me" sounds kind of strange, because here's this man who's probably 50 years old or so saying to this young guy, "Be a father to me." Joseph used this same language when he was explaining to his family where he had been and what he'd done. He said he became a father to Pharaoh. In that sense, he was a counselor. So, be a counselor and a priest to me. But to me, where do we get personal priests? Was a priest ever assigned to a person? It seems like nothing's going according to the law here. So Micah consecrated him again. By what authority? Who gave Micah the right to consecrate priests? And then Micah's response, or his statement, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing that I have a Levite as a priest." This is the thing I think most supports the idea that this is a money-making venture. Because now he's got an official Levite, not just his kid. Now, this is just, mulling this over for however many weeks it's been, and trying to say, well, what's going on behind the scenes here? This is my impression. It kind of fits together, but it's sketchy evidence. So I cannot present this as though this is the truth. It's what seems to fit. And prosper me? What does this mean? I'm going to make some money. I will, I don't know how else to put it. God's going to give me money because I got me a Levite. That sounds pretty crude, doesn't it? Yes. And he has a Levitical priest to guide the worship to these idols. Good point. As though that preacher is going to make the difference for the individuals. So what's the significance of having a Levite as a priest? By the way, the text never said this Levite was a priest. All priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. So maybe this guy was one of the families that was assigned to, I don't know, do something around the door of the tabernacle and never actually go inside. Well, he got a promotion. Now he's a priest. We don't know. Again, this is, what does the text say? What does it not say? The Danite migration. Here again, we see that thing about the no king. We'll let that one rest for a couple weeks. It says the Danites were seeking territory because they didn't have any. What? They had been given this whole region. That was their allocation described in Joshua, I believe, chapter 12. So they were north of Judah, south of Ephraim and Manasseh, the little bit over to the far, the little section way over next to the Mediterranean Sea was Manasseh. So Benjamin to the west, Judah to the south, Ephraim and Manasseh to the north. They had this whole area. If you remember from our, I think, second week, those two in red, Sha'albim and Ayalon, were the ones that they specifically did not conquer. And you may recall that the text said that the Amorites down in the valleys wouldn't let them come down. So they were stuck up in the hills. They actually had these two cities, which was the area Samson was from, Zerah and Eshtaol. They had that area, but this is up in the hills. They were supposed to have taken this whole area. But apparently, they didn't. They were still having problems with the Philistines at Samson's time. And so they say, hey, let's go somewhere else. And they sent out five men to go spy out the land and find someplace else. What's the question? What's the question I'm fishing for? It's the same one we keep running over and over again. By what authority? Who told Dan, well, if you don't like the assignment you were given, you can just go off and take something else? Where they actually went, well, they went to search the land. We'll get where they actually went to. They came to Micah's house. They were going up through Ephraim, and they came to Micah's house. And they recognized the voice of the Levite. Now, different translations have different wordings here. It's not very likely that they actually knew this man, that they would know his voice personally. But they may have recognized his accent. We have evidence from a previous chapter that they had tribal dialects. Remember, let me see if I've got this written here. In Judges 12, where the men of Gilead were fighting the Ephraimites, and they went and they took the fords, and when the Ephraimites tried to get home, they'd say Shibboleth. Most would say Shibboleth, but Shibboleth. And they'd say Shibboleth, because they didn't pronounce that. It was not. It was a regionalism or a tribal dialect. They did not speak that way. So if you heard somebody, and every time they were supposed to say, shh, they said, hey, that person's from Ephraim. So it's very likely that the Levites had their dialect as well, that they may have recognized him by that. At any rate, they recognized that he ain't from around here. Whereas they say, you're not from these parts, are you? And they started questioning him. Who brought you here? Well, he said, you know, I was in Bethlehem. I came up, found this place. What are you doing here? He explained, he would have explained that he had been hired as a priest. And so he was here doing this. And what do you have here? I have idols. I have an ephod. I have these things that people come to see. And they come to worship these things or worship before these things. And they, oh, okay. Apparently they were impressed enough to say, well, would you inquire of God for us to let us know if what we're doing here is going to be prosperous? Now, the text does not say that the Levite actually inquired of God. He just said, it's okay, keep going. By what authority? That's the question that keeps coming up over and over and over again. By what authority are they doing these things? By what authority are they making these decisions? By what authority are they making these pronouncements? So they came to Laish. That's way up in the north, way up there where the arrow is. So you have the Sea of Galilee and then Lake Hula and way on up there. That appears to be the very north fringe of the region of Naphtali. This is somebody else's allocation. It was given to another tribe. They were not authorized to go there and take that land. They had their area that they were authorized to go. And they didn't. They took a little bit. They never got out of the hills. There was all this land of the valleys and the plains that they could have taken if they would have put their forces to it. But maybe the Philistines were just too tough, too scary. So let's go someplace easy. And they found the people of Laish were a very quiet people, unsuspecting, living peaceably. Didn't bother anybody. Nobody bothered them. It was just kind of out there. You can see this mountain range between the coast and this valley going up there, which pretty much isolated them from any of the powers on the coast coming and bothering them. And they're kind of up there. This was along a road, a trade route, but quiet people living peaceably, easy pickings. So they came to Laish, located in the region of Naphtali, and again, what business did they have in somebody else's inheritance? So they went back. And they gave a good report. Basically, easy pickings, go get it. No, these people aren't going to put up much of a fight. And so the 600 men of war, set out from Zerah and Eshtaol, and they headed up the same way they came to Micah's place. Then the five men who went to spy out said to their kinsmen, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, and household idols, and a graven image, and a molten image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do. What do they mean? Consider what you should do. If they were faithful and they knew that this idol worship was going on there, what would they do? What did they do? Yes. That's a nice way of putting it. They appropriate. Yeah. So they went in and took the idols, the ephod, and convinced the priest. When they came out with this stuff, the priest, what are you doing? And they said, shut up. Nicely, put your hand over your mouth. Be quiet. Don't argue with us. Which is better for you, to be a priest to this one man or to be a priest to a whole tribe of Israel? Whoa, this is a promotion. This was good. And the priest was happy with this thought, and he went along with him. So, yeah, good. You know, I got a big raise. And so they bundled everything up and took off. Micah and his neighbors, when they found out what happened, pursued him, came up behind him. Hey, what's the matter with you? You stole my idols. You stole my gods that I made. Gods that I made. That's an interesting one. You've taken away my gods and my priest. And what do I have left? They've just taken away his means of business. Or whatever it was that he was doing there. How can you say to me, what's the matter with you? And Dan, the people of Dan just said, hey, be quiet, leave us alone. And when they saw that they were too strong for him, they left and went home. You know, they were not ready to take on 600 men and get killed, so they just went home. Cut your losses and go. So Dan went on to Laish. They killed everybody and burned the city. Well, that's what they were supposed to do in their own territory. Why are they doing this in somebody else's allocation? And then they rebuilt it and lived there, and they called it Dan. So they changed the name of it. And they set up the graven image, and the priest, who we now find his name is Jonathan, son of Gershom, he and his sons served there as priests until things got all torn up. But they served a long time there. So we have Dan well established in the practice of idolatry. You'll recall later on that when Jeroboam did not want the people to go to Jerusalem to worship, he made the golden calves, and he set one in Dan and the other in Bethel. So Dan already had this history. Apparently they didn't object to it at all. Now, some translations say Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses. The Hebrew in there says Manasseh. They try to say that he was Moses' grandson. If this is along the timeline where we think it is, toward the end of this whole period, this is 300 and some years after Joshua. Now, even with some mighty long-lived people, 300 years to get from father to son to grandson is not realistic. This is not the lifespan that people were having at those times. So either this had to happen much earlier in the period of the Judges, or it's just a mistranslation. Now, Moses did have a son named Gershom, and he was born before the burning bush. So he was not a young man when all this took place. Well, not that old. But to say that Jonathan was his son, I don't think is very likely. Because it would just make him too old. Jonathan would not have been a young man, even if Gershom lived to be 120 and had a baby on the last day, Jonathan would not have been a young man at that point if he was the grandson of Moses. Okay. That was a very cheery one, wasn't it? Next week is worse. Much worse. Judges 19 through 21. I mean, if you thought it doesn't get worse than this, bizarre, shocking, the things that happen in those three chapters are appalling. But we don't have to go too far today to find similar kinds of things happening around us. People get used to things. You know, you get used to abortion clinics and things like that. It's been there. You know, it's just the way society is. We've got a lot of stuff that is, in some ways, as appalling, if not more so, than some of the things we're going to read about in this next week. So try to get past the shock and revulsion and look at what's going on, why people are doing what they're doing, what's being said about it and what's not being said. Try to put yourself into these people's minds. What are they thinking? And, wait a minute, do I think like that? We've all heard this thing of apostasy is just one generation away. I wouldn't say that. It's today or tomorrow. Depending on our attitudes. It's not our children. It's us that make the choices every last day. And if we go into these same kinds of attitudes as the people that we're reading about, that's the road we're going down. Nobody's in, you know, the once saved, always saved. We know that's not the way it works. We still have to pay attention to the way we walk. Could I be any more cheerful? Any comments? Yes, Neil. We'll talk more about that in 2 weeks. When we kind of come back as sort of a wrap-up and overview, if we can get through 19 through 21 next week, we may have to finish some of that in 2 weeks from now. But certainly this discussion of who's king, who's supposed to be king, and I'd also like to suggest thinking about kings. Was there supposed to be a king? When they did have kings, how did they do? And how do people react to human authority? Just some thoughts to go through as you're reading and thinking about this stuff. That's it for today. Thank you very much.